Chapter 5. Bâle. And so I am in Paris. Don't think, however, that I shall tell you a lot about Paris itself. I should think you have already read so much about it in Russian that you are tired of reading about it by now. Besides, you have been there yourselves, and have probably seen it all better than I have. I never could abide, when I was abroad, looking at things in the proper way as approved by the guidebooks, as every good traveller should. I am now ashamed to own up to the things I have sometimes missed in consequence. In Paris, too, I have missed seeing certain things. I shall not say what they were, but I will say one thing. I have found a definition for Paris, have selected an epithet for it, and shall stand by this epithet. It is this. It is the most moral and the most virtuous town in the whole world. What order, what sweet reasonableness, what definite and firmly established relationships, how buttoned up and secure everything is, how perfectly pleased and happy they all are, and how hard they have all tried. So hard that they have really convinced themselves that they are pleased and perfectly happy, and have stopped there. There can be no further advance. You will never believe that they have stopped there. You will say that I exaggerate, that this is all a libel invented by a bilious patriot, that things could not, in fact, have stopped dead. But, my friends, I have warned you as far back as the first chapter of these notes, you know, that I may tell dreadful lies. So don't stand in the way. You surely know, too, that if I tell lies, I shall tell them in the conviction that I'm not telling them. Personally, I think this should amply suffice you, and you had better give me full freedom. Oh, indeed, Paris is a remarkable town, and how much comfort and convenience is put at the disposal of those who have a right to comfort and convenience. And again, what order, what stillness of order, so to speak. I keep harking back to order. Indeed, a little longer, and Paris, with its 1.5 million inhabitants, will become like some small German university town, fossilized in stillness and order, something like Heidelberg, for example. It seems to be tending that way. And why shouldn't there be a Heidelberg on a colossal scale? And what regimentation! Don't misunderstand me. I don't mean so much external regimentation, which is insignificant, relatively, of course, but a colossal internal spiritual regimentation having its sources in the very depths of the soul. Paris tries to contract, willingly, lovingly somehow tries to make itself smaller than it really is, tries to shrink within itself, smiling benignly as it does so. Now, London is in this respect something entirely different. I only spent 8 days altogether in London, and the impression it left upon my mind, superficially at least, was of something on a grand scale, of vivid planning, original and not forced into a common mould. Everything there is so vast and so harsh in its originality. This originality is even a bit deceptive. Every harshness and every inconsistency is able to live in harmony with its antithesis and persist in walking hand in hand with it, continuing to be inconsistent, but apparently by no means excluding its antithesis. Each part stoutly upholds its own way, and apparently does not interfere with the other parts of the whole. And yet there, too, the same stubborn, silent, and by now chronic struggle is carried on, the struggle to the death of the typically Western principle of individual isolation, with the necessity to live in some sort of harmony with each other, to create some sort of community, and to settle down in the same anthill. Even turning into an anthill seems desirable. Anything to be able to settle down without having to devour each other. The alternative is to turn into cannibals. In this connection, however, both Paris and London have one thing in common, the same desperate yearning, born of despair, to retain the status quo, to tear out by the roots all desires and hopes they might harbour within them, to damn the future in which perhaps even the very leaders of progress lack faith, and to bow down in worship of Baal. But please do not get carried away by this lofty language. All this can be consciously felt only in the minds of the more advanced and clear-headed individuals, and unconsciously and by instinct in the living, everyday actions of the masses. But the ordinary man, the bourgeois in Paris, for instance, is almost consciously well satisfied and convinced that everything is as it should be, and may even beat you up if you express a doubt on that score. But he will do so because he is still a little nervous in spite of all his self-confidence. In that way, London is much the same, but what an overwhelming spectacle it presents, painted on a vast canvas. Even superficially, how different it is from Paris. The immense town, forever bustling by night and by day, as vast as an ocean, the screech and howl of machinery, the railways built above the houses, and soon to be built under them, the daring of enterprise, the apparent disorder which in actual fact is the highest form of bourgeois order, the polluted Thames, the coal-saturated air, the magnificent squares and parks, the town's terrifying districts such as Whitechapel with its half-naked, savage and hungry population, the city with its millions and its worldwide trade, the Crystal Palace, the World Exhibition. The exhibition is indeed amazing. You feel the terrible force which has brought these innumerable people who have come from the ends of the earth all together into one fold. You realize the grandeur of the idea. You feel that something has been achieved here, that here is victory and triumph, and you feel nervous. However great your independence of mind, a feeling of fear somehow creeps over you. Can this, you think, in fact be the final accomplishment of an ideal state of things? Is this the end by any chance? Perhaps this really is the one fold. Perhaps we shall really have to accept this as the whole truth and cease from all movement thereafter. It is all so solemn, triumphant and proud that you are left breathless. You look at those hundreds of thousands, at those millions of people obediently trooping into this place from all parts of the earth, people who have come with only one thought in mind, quietly, stubbornly and silently milling round in this colossal place, and you feel that something final has been accomplished here, accomplished and completed. It is a biblical sight. Something to do with Babylon, some prophecy out of the apocalypse being fulfilled before your very eyes. You feel that a rich and ancient tradition of denial and protest is needed in order not to yield, not to succumb to impression, not to bow down in worship of fact, and not to idolize Baal, that is, not to take the actual for the ideal. But this, you will say, is nonsense, morbid nonsense, nerves, exaggeration. No one will halt there, and no one will take this for his ideal. Besides, hunger and slavery are no friends to anyone, and will, no one better, suggest denial and give rise to scepticism. But dilettantes, replete and satisfied and strolling about for their own delectation, can, of course, conjure up pictures out of the apocalypse and excite their nervous systems by exaggeration and by extorting powerful sensations out of every fact for the sake of auto-stimulation. All right, I reply, let us admit I had been carried away by the decor. I may have been. But if you had seen how proud the mighty spirit is which created that colossal decor, and how convinced it is of its victory and its triumph, you would have shuddered at its pride, its obstinacy, its blindness, and you would have shuddered too at the thought of those over whom that proud spirit hovers and reigns supreme. In the presence of such immensity, in the presence of the unbounded pride of the dominating spirit and of the triumphant finality of the world created by that spirit, the hungry soul often quails, yields and submits, seeks its salvation in gin and debauchery, and succumbs to a belief in the rightness of the existing order. Reality oppresses. The masses become insensitive and acquire oriental passivity, while the more sceptical among them curse their fate and gloomily look for salvation to Mormonism and such like. And in London, the masses can be seen on a scale and in conditions not to be seen anywhere else in the world. I have been told, for example, that on Saturday night, 500,000 working men and women and their children spread like the ocean all over town, clustering particularly in certain districts, and celebrate their Sabbath all night long until 5 o'clock in the morning. In other words, guzzle and drink like beasts to make up for a whole week. They bring with them their weekly savings, all that was earned by hard work and with many a curse. Great jets of gas burn in meat and food shops, brightly lighting up the streets. It is as if a grand reception were being held for these white Negroes. Crowds throng the open taverns and the streets. There they eat and drink. The beer houses are decorated like palaces. Everyone is drunk, but drunk joylessly, gloomily and heavily, and everyone is somehow strangely silent. Only curses and bloody brawls occasionally break that suspicious and oppressively sad silence. Everyone is in a hurry to drink himself into insensibility. Wives in no way lag behind their husbands, and all get drunk together, while children crawl and run about among them. One such night, it was getting on for 2 o'clock in the morning, I lost my way, and for a long time trudged the streets in the midst of a vast crowd of gloomy people, asking my way almost by gestures, because I do not know a word of English. I found my way, but the impression of what I had seen tormented me for 3 days afterwards. The populace is much the same anywhere, but there all was so vast, so vivid, that you almost physically felt things which, up till then, you had only imagined. In London, you no longer see the populace. Instead, you see a loss of sensibility, systematic, resigned, and encouraged. And you feel, as you look at all those social pariahs, that it will be a long time before the prophecy is fulfilled for them, a long time before they are given palm branches and white robes, and that for a long time yet they will continue to appeal to the throne of the Almighty, crying, "How long, O Lord?" And they know it themselves, and in the meantime take their revenge on society by producing all kinds of underground Mormons, Shakers, tramps. We are surprised at the stupidity which leads people to become Shakers and tramps, and fail to understand that what we have here is a repudiation of our social formula, an obstinate and unconscious repudiation, an instinctive repudiation at any cost, in order to achieve salvation, a horrified and disgusted repudiation of the rest of us. Those millions of people, abandoned and driven away from the feast of humanity, push and crush each other in the underground darkness into which they have been cast by their elder brethren. They grope around seeking a door at which to knock and look for an exit lest they be smothered to death in that dark cellar. This is the last desperate attempt to huddle together and form one's own heap, one's own mass, and to repudiate everything, the very image of man if need be, only to be oneself, only not to be with us. I saw in London another and similar mass, such as you would never see on a like scale anywhere else. An unusual spectacle it certainly was. Anyone who has ever visited London must have been at least once in the Haymarket at night. It is a district in certain streets of which prostitutes swarm by night in their thousands. Streets are lit by jets of gas, something completely unknown in our own country. At every step you come across magnificent public houses, all mirrors and gilt. They serve as meeting places as well as shelters. It is a terrifying experience to find oneself in that crowd. And what an odd amalgam it is. You will find old women there and beautiful women at the sight of whom you stop in amazement. There are no women in the world as beautiful as the English. The street can hardly accommodate the dense, seething crowd. The mob has not enough room on the pavements and swamps the whole street. All this mass of humanity craves for booty and hurls itself at the first comer with shameless cynicism. Glistening, expensive clothes and semi-rags and sharp differences in age, they are all there. A drunken tramp shuffling along in this terrible crowd is jostled by the rich and titled. You hear curses, quarrels, solicitations, and the quiet, whispered invitation of some still bashful beauty. And how beautiful they sometimes are with their keepsake faces. I remember once I went into a casino. The music was blaring, people were dancing, a huge crowd was milling round. The place was magnificently decorated. But gloom never forsakes the English, even in the midst of gaiety. Even when they dance, they look serious, not to say sullen, making hardly any steps, and then only as if in execution of some duty. Upstairs, in the gallery, I saw a girl and stopped in amazement. She was sitting at a little table together with an apparently rich and respectable young man who, by all the signs, was an unaccustomed visitor to the casino. Perhaps he had been looking for her, and they had at last found each other and arranged to meet there. He spoke to her little, and only in short, jerky phrases, as if he was not talking about what really interested him. Their conversation was punctuated by long and frequent silences. She, too, looked sad. Her face was delicate and fine, and there was something deep-hidden and sad, something thoughtful and melancholy in the proud expression of her eyes. I should say she had consumption. Mentally and morally she was, she could not fail to be, above the whole crowd of those wretched women. Otherwise, what meaning would there be in a human face? All the same, however, she was then and there drinking gin paid for by the young man. At last he got up, shook hands with her, and went away. He left the casino, while she, her pale cheeks now flushed deep with drink, was soon lost in the crowd of women trading in their bodies. In the Haymarket I noticed mothers who brought their little daughters to make them ply that same trade. Little girls, aged about 12, seize you by the arm and beg you to come with them. I remember once, amidst the crowd of people in the street, I saw a little girl, not older than 6, all in rags, dirty, barefoot and hollow-cheeked. She had been severely beaten, and her body, which showed through the rags, was covered with bruises. She was walking along, as if oblivious of everybody and everything, in no hurry to get anywhere. And heaven knows why loafing about in that crowd. Perhaps she was hungry. Nobody was paying any attention to her. But what struck me most was the look of such distress, such hopeless despair on her face, that to see that tiny bit of humanity already bearing the imprint of all that evil and despair was somehow unnatural and terribly painful. She kept on shaking her tousled head as if arguing about something, gesticulated and spread her little hands, and then suddenly clasped them together and pressed them to her little bare breast. I went back and gave her 6p. She took the small silver coin, gave me a wild look full of frightened surprise, and suddenly ran off as fast as her legs could carry her, as if afraid that I should take the money away from her. Jolly scenes altogether. And then one night, in the midst of a crowd of loose women and debauchees, I was stopped by a woman making her way hurriedly through it. She was dressed all in black, and her hat almost concealed her face. In fact, I had hardly time to make it out. I only remember the steady gaze of her eyes. She said something in broken French which I failed to understand, thrust a piece of paper into my hand, and hurried on. I examined the paper at the light of a café window. It was a small square slip. One side bore the words, "Quoi tout cela?" printed on it. The other, also in French, "I am the resurrection and the life," etc., the well-known text. This, too, you must admit, is rather bizarre. It was explained to me afterwards that that was Catholic propaganda ferreting round everywhere, persistent and tireless. Sometimes they distribute these bits of paper in the streets, sometimes booklets containing extracts from the New Testament and the Bible. They distribute them free, thrust them into people's hands, press them on people. It is ingenious and cunning propaganda. A Catholic priest would search out and insinuate himself into a poor workman's family. He would find, for example, a sick man lying in his rags on a damp floor, surrounded by children crazy from cold and hunger, with a wife famished and often drunk. He would feed them all, provide clothes and warmth for them, give treatment to the sick man, buy medicine for him, become the friend of the family, and finally convert them all to the Catholic faith. Sometimes, however, after the sick man has been restored to health, the priest is driven out with curses and kicks. He does not despair and goes off to someone else. He is chucked out again, but puts up with everything and catches someone in the end. But an Anglican minister would never visit a poor man. The poor are not even allowed inside a church because they have not the money to pay for a seat. More often than not, working-class men and women and the poor generally live together in illegitimate union, as marriages are expensive. Many husbands, by the way, beat their wives horribly and disfigure them to the point of death, mostly with the aid of pokers used to break up coal in open grates. They seem to regard them specifically as instruments for beating purposes. At least in describing family quarrels, injuries and murders, newspapers always mention pokers. The children of the poor, while still very young, often go out into the streets, merge with the crowd, and in the end fail to return to their parents. Anglican ministers and bishops are proud and rich, live in wealthy parishes and dioceses, and wax fat with an entirely untroubled conscience. They are great pedants, are highly educated, and pompously and seriously believe in their own solidly moral virtues, and in their right to preach a staid and complacent morality, to grow fat and to live here for the sake of the rich. It is a religion of the rich, and undisguised at that. At least this is rational, and no one is being deceived. The professors of religion, who carry their convictions to the point of obtuseness, have one amusement, if such it can be called. It is missionary work. They travel all over the earth, penetrate into darkest Africa to convert one savage and forget the million savages in London because these have nothing to pay with them. But wealthy Englishmen, and in fact all the golden calves in that country, are extremely religious, gloomily, sullenly, and peculiarly so. English poets have, from time immemorial, been fond of celebrating the beauty of provincial vicarages, standing in the shade of ancient oaks and elms, their virtuous wives and ideally beautiful blonde and blue-eyed daughters. But when night is over and day begins, the same proud and gloomy spirit once again spreads its lordly wings over the gigantic city. It is not worried by what happened during the night, neither is it worried by what it sees all around itself by day. Baal reigns and does not even demand obedience, because he is certain of it. He has boundless faith in himself. Contemptuously and calmly, and only so as to be left alone, he organizes almsgiving, and his self-confidence is not to be shaken. Baal does not close his eyes, as they do in Paris, for instance, to certain savage suspicions and alarming facts of life. The poverty, suffering, complaints, and torpor of the masses do not worry him in the slightest. Contemptuously, he allows these suspicions and ominous facts to jostle his own life, to sit on his own doorstep for everyone to see. Unlike a Parisian, he does not make strenuous, if cowardly, attempts to convince himself of the falsity of facts, boost his own morale, and report to himself that all is quiet and fine. He does not hide his paw, as is done in Paris, lest they disturb and needlessly trouble his sleep. The Parisian likes sticking his head in the sand like an ostrich, so as not to see his pursuers catching up with him. In Paris... But what am I talking about? I am not in Paris yet. Oh, when, my God, will I learn to be orderly?